So today we are going to apply the techniques we discussed last week to quantum field theory, and in particular to two different applications. So we'll spend the first part of today's lecture discussing a generalization of the decay problem that we briefly discussed on Friday's lecture. So the problem we'll be interested in is we have a scalar field theory with a potential that has a metastable minimum. So here, if phi is equal to phi f everywhere, that's a field configuration that is a local minimum of the action, or it's also a local. It's a field configuration that's a local minimum of the energy. But the global minimum, the vacuum state, the classical vacuum state, is where phi is equal to what I call phi t everywhere. So if we have a field that starts out in an initial state where phi is equal to phi f everywhere, we'd expect quantum mechanically it could tunnel so that phi is equal to phi t, at least in some region of space. So that's the process we'll examine in the first part of lecture, where a field can tunnel from some metastable vacuum to a true vacuum. And so this metastable vacuum is sometimes called a false vacuum. Because if we just look locally in field space, this looks like a vacuum state. But global considerations tell us this is not actually a vacuum state. So that'll be the first part of lecture. And in the second part of lecture, we will examine the ground state of non-abelian gauge theory. We likely won't finish that today, and we'll continue with that discussion next time. Okay. And in both cases, we'll see that there are close analogies to what we did last week. So in the decay of the false vacuum, there will be some close analogies with the field theory case, with the quantum mechanical decay problem we looked at last time. And for the theta vacua, the vacuum of non-abelian gauge theory, we'll see some close analogs with the periodic potential we looked at last time. Okay. So this is the problem we're going to study. And throughout, for simplicity, we'll assume that the scalar field has a canonical kinetic term, so that the Lagrangian looks like this. And the instanton method almost generalizes directly from what we did last week. So last week we discussed instantons in one-dimensional quantum mechanics, but almost nothing would change if we discussed instantons in two-dimensional quantum mechanics. The instanton method is a method for computing contributions to amplitudes from non-trivial saddle points, non-trivial solutions to the equations of motion. And what would change if we were looking for a solution to the Euclidean equations of motion in two dimensions instead of one is, well, we would just have to solve two-dimensional equation of motion, and possibly the boundary conditions would be different. And we can think about quantum field theory as basically an infinite dimensional limit of quantum mechanics, where we've got one degree of freedom for each point in space. And so with that analogy in mind, the instanton method is basically carries over directly. The two differences are we'll be solving a different equation of motion, and we will need to think carefully about what types of boundary conditions we need to apply, because that aspect can change depending on dimension of the problem. So what we want to compute, so our basic fact we're going to use is that QFT is basically an infinite dimensional quantum mechanics. So our techniques will work with just a few modifications. And so what we computed in the quantum mechanical case was the decay rate. If we are asking just about the decay rate, we're going to get a nonsensical answer in the quantum field theory case. And that's because this decay process essentially has to be local. So if the field, which we're assuming initially is in the state phi equals phi f everywhere, tunnels everywhere to phi equals phi t, any configuration like that is going to have infinite action, and therefore we can't study that using the saddle point method, because e to the minus infinity is zero. So we expect the tunneling solutions with finite action to just locally tunnel from phi equals phi f to phi t. So we can imagine some region of spacetime inside of which phi is close to phi t. And so tunneling is a localized process. So if we ask what is the decay rate everywhere in spacetime, and we've got a finite decay rate per unit volume integrated over an infinite volume of spacetime, we're going to get a divergent answer. So the sensible question to ask is not about what is the decay rate, but what is the decay rate per unit volume. So that's what we're going to compute today. And so that's one of the differences between the quantum field theory case and the quantum mechanical case. So this will be finite. Because decay is localized. Another way to describe this process is as the nucleation of bubbles. So that's one way we can describe this process. So we're starting off with a field configuration that's in a metal stable state, and we're asking what is the rate per unit volume of the nucleation of a bubble inside of which the field has a different volume. So they're very close analogs between the problem we're studying and phase transitions in other contexts. And based on what we saw last week, we expect the answer is some prefactor times e to the minus Euclidean action of a finite action solution to the Euclidean equations of motion, where this prefactor, again, is proportional to the determinant with the zero eigenvalues removed of s double prime. And phi here is a finite action solution to the Euclidean equations of motion, just like before. So again, we're using the saddle point approximation to try to compute an amplitude, and then from an amplitude, we can read off the ground state energy, which tells us about the decay rate, just like we saw last week. So the difference is that we're considering a different action, which is now our Euclidean action will be involve not just an integral over Euclidean time, but it will also involve an integral over space. So it contains a term just like the one kinetic term we studied before, Now integrated over space. And it also contains gradient. And potential term. And if we want to make the analogy with what we did last time clear, we have a new term here, this gradient term, which didn't appear in the one-dimensional quantum mechanical problem. And to make the analogy with what we did last week clear, we should think of both of these terms together as like the potential in the quantum mechanics problem. They neither involve time derivatives, so this will be a useful thing to think about. If we, as we'll explore in the tutorial this afternoon, if you try to make the analogy using between the quantum field theory case and the quantum mechanical case, making the map that U is like V, very strange things happen, and the analogy doesn't really make sense. But as long as we remember that the gradient term is also there, this analogy makes sense, and there you can learn a lot physically about what you expect to happen in the quantum field theory case by mapping it to what you know about how tunneling in quantum mechanics works. Okay, so that's one difference, is we have this extra gradient term. Another difference between the quantum field theory case and the quantum mechanics case are the boundary conditions. So in quantum mechanics, when we were studying the potential, it looks like this. What we were computing was an amplitude to go from some position to some position, and the only reasonable boundary conditions we can impose was that the initial and final position of the particle was where x was equal to x star. Any other choice would not give us finite action solutions. And so the same thing is true here. So if we, the only way we can get a finite action solution to the equations of motion is if phi starts at phi f and ends at phi f. It's the only way we can have the potential be zero and the gradient zero if it's equal to that and approaches it phi f slowly, then that will give us a finite action solution. So we should have that limit of phi bar as tau goes to plus or minus infinity phi f. This is just essentially the analog of our quantum mechanical boundary conditions. But we need more than that for a solution of our equations of motion to have finite action in the quantum field theory case. We're dealing with a field on space-time rather than just the position of a particle. So in particular, if phi does not approach phi f, as our spatial coordinates go to infinity, then we have no chance of having a finite action solution as well. So we also need to impose that as our spatial coordinates go to infinity, our field approaches phi f. And, well, we can unify these conditions if we work in hyperspherical coordinates. these become limit rho goes to infinity. So here, rho squared is tau squared plus x squared. It's just the radius on hyperspherical coordinates. And, well, in general, solving these boundary conditions without any other information would be a very difficult problem. Because phi bar would be a function of tau and our three spatial coordinates. But it can actually be proven that the lowest action solution to the Euclidean equations of motion is O4 symmetric. Which greatly simplifies our life.
Can you repeat the argument why in our case where we have a second well where it's not going to infinity, we still have to finish in phi f at the tau equals infinity. I'm not sure what would be the problem to be in the other part of the potential if tau equals infinity.
Okay, so I've chosen my potential so that u of phi f is 0, u of phi t is non-zero, it's negative. So if we look at our Euclidean action, we want this integral to be finite over our solution phi bar. So if phi bar does not approach by f at infinity, then we'll have this term will approach a constant. And if we integrate a constant over an infinite volume, we'll get something divergent.
I just want to ask a quick question because I don't think so it's kind of what Remy was saying about this decaying to the phi t. Like, why do we call it a decay of a false vacuum if we're going back to where we started? Because to me, I guess when I'm thinking of decay, I'm thinking you go down to the smaller or to the lower well.
Okay, yes. So we're computing basically an amplitude for our have phi of phi equals phi f evolving for some Euclidean time and going back to the state phi equals phi f. So this is what we're computing. And if this amplitude was 1, then that would tell us that this was a energy eigenstate, and we could remain in that eigenstate after a time evolution. Mm-hmm. What we actually find is that when we compute this amplitude, we can extract the ground state energy from it, is minus the limit as t goes to infinity of h bar over t log z, this is z. So if we compute the ground state energy from this, we find that this amplitude will be purely imaginary. So the ground state energy is going to contain an imaginary part, which is related to the decay rate. So we're computing this amplitude, the amplitude for phi to remain in phi f, even though that's not what we're interested in.
Okay.
But that's the easiest thing we can compute that tells us about the decay rate.
once again, I asked this question the first class, but it all seems very dependent on a constant. So the argument to try to find a finite action depended crucially on the fact that phi of f has potential energy zero.
Yes.
While phi t has negative potential energy. But once again, I don't get what's like.
So,
I mean, if I shifted everything by minus u of phi t, then phi t is the one that has action zero, and ending at phi t would be what gives me finite action solution.
Yeah, yes, really. A more correct statement is that we should look at solutions which have a finite difference in action with the lowest action solution that obeys our boundary conditions. So if we shifted everything up, we should, so we can imagine shifting this up so that phi f was at some finite positive value and phi t was at zero, then this formula would have an extra term. We would want to, in the exponent, we'd have the action of our instanton minus the action of the field configuration where phi just sat at phi f everywhere. So it would be changed to. And this term just is zero if we make the choice that u of phi f is zero.
But we're looking for so in there we're already assuming that our boundary conditions were those, but precisely the argument, like after Remy's question, the argument that we gave to make those the boundary conditions were precisely that the action vanishes already at phi f, right?
Yes, then the correct statement would be that the difference in the action was zero, was finite. So both of these will diverge, and you'd have to regulate them, like the limit. It can be done. It's just an extra complication.
That this is just a kind of choice to make it like being zero at the phi f position, and because we just don't care about the global coefficient before gamma.
This coefficient. Yes, and for many applications we don't.
If we just introduce some other value for our potential energy, then we just get nothing but a global coefficient.
That's right. The physics, at least if we're doing non-gravitational physics, shouldn't depend on where we shift this to.
So it's just a choice.
It's just a choice. Our derivations from last time, from last week, if we went through quantum mechanical problem and shifted everything up, and we carefully did the saddle point approximation, we just see we'd have to have this extra term if we made a different choice for where our zeros were. Okay, so I'll continue to make that choice that u of phi f is zero, just so I can forget about this term. So I made the claim that the lowest action solution to the Euclidean equations of motion is O4 symmetric. Coleman and collaborators have a nice proof of this in the non-gravitational case that we're looking at, just a real scalar field. I'm not going to go through the details of that, but it does simplify our problem. Instead of solving a differential equation, a PDE, we just have to solve an ODE. It's a function of a single variable instead of PDE that's a function of four space-time variables. So if we solve the equations of motion in hyperspherical coordinates, we've got one boundary at infinity. We'll also need another boundary condition at rho equals 0. So we should have that our solution is non-singular. So we'll impose the boundary condition that d phi d rho is 0 at rho equals 0. So our solution is non-singular. We wouldn't need this boundary condition if we didn't work in hyperspherical coordinates, but it would also be much harder to solve equations of motion. So in that case, so in hyperspherical coordinates, our equation motion become d squared phi bar rho squared. We get an extra term because we're in hyperspherical coordinates. D phi 3 over rho d phi bar d rho. And this is equal to u prime phi bar. And u prime is du d phi. So this equation of motion looks like the equation of motion for a particle moving in a potential. These two terms are just very familiar from classical mechanics. We've got this extra term here, which we can think of as a time dependent, because the coefficient depends on rho, damping force. So this equation is like a particle moving in the potential minus u with time or rho dependent damping force. So the analogy here is that phi bar is like the position of a particle in just ordinary classical mechanics, and rho is like the time. So using the observation that the differential equation we're trying to solve is can be mapped to a classical mechanics problem for a particle moving in a one dimension, we can use what we know about classical mechanics to examine what the solutions to this equation look like. So we want to study a particle moving in the inverted potential, because we don't have a minus sign here. So our inverted potential looks like this. Here's phi f. Here's phi t, and I'm going to label the one of the other points where u is equal to 0 as phi star. This is the classical turning point. If there were no damping forces, a particle with zero energy that started at phi f could roll to phi star and bounce back. So the first question we have is there always a solution to this equation of motion with these boundary conditions? So it turns out in this case, the answer is yes. If you couple the same system to gravity, the answer is no. It's not always a solution. So it's an interesting question then, whether or not there is a solution like this. It tells us whether or not decay is allowed. And so to see that there is always a solution, which means that there always is a way for a field that's initially in the state phi equals phi f everywhere to locally decay to phi equals phi t. We need to basically identify a trajectory that solves these boundary conditions and this equation of motion. These boundary conditions are not typical boundary conditions in classical mechanics, even though this equation of motion is one that we could imagine encountering in classical mechanics. We're imposing a condition on the velocity of the particle at time, or rho, equals zero, and the position of the particle at time goes to infinity. So a more common problem to look at in classical mechanics is where you impose boundary conditions that tell us what the initial position and velocity of the particle are. We're doing something different here. So it's not obvious that solution does exist, but we can argue that a solution does exist by finding a so our strategy will be to argue that there exists a phi bar of zero, some place we can start the particle with zero velocity, so that at infinity it ends up at phi f. Okay, so, and we're going to do this by a continuity argument. So we're going to find a place that we can start the particle with zero velocity so that it doesn't reach phi f, and a solution so that it goes past phi f. And by continuity, there should be some phi bar of zero so that it ends exactly at phi f. So solution that doesn't reach phi f we'll call an undershooting solution, just doesn't reach there. And that's easy to find. So if we start phi at phi star, well, if there was no damping, it would reach phi f. We do have a damping term, so which is going to take energy away from the particle, so it's not going to have enough energy to reach phi f. So there's our undershooting solution. So that never reaches phi f. Also, see that there is an overshooting solution. So if we start, our best chance of having an overshooting solution is to start as close as possible to phi t. That's the most possible energy we can have because we're starting with zero velocity. So let's start with phi of zero as approximately phi t. So in this case, if we start sufficiently close to phi t, we'll stay near phi t for a long time because the slope of the potential is very small here. If we stay there long enough, the longer we stay there, the smaller the damping term becomes, because the damping term decays with time. If we stay there sufficiently long, we can make this damping term as small as possible. If there's no damping term, then a particle that starts at phi t will go past phi f, and therefore will overshoot. So by continuity, there should be some place where we can start in between phi star and phi t, so that at phi equals infinity, at rho equals infinity, phi will equal phi f. So there's always a solution, and in this non-gravitational case, false vacuum can always decay. Okay. In general, it's hard to find exact solutions to this equation of motion, these boundary conditions. But there's one limit in which we can find approximate solutions, which will give us some insight into the physics of this process. And that's the thin wall limit. So let's assume that u of phi plus is very close to u of phi f. So that in this inverted potential, just a phi t is just a very small positive number. In that case, we can sketch what we expect the solution to look like. So we know that, so let's sketch here, the solution is a sketch of phi bar versus rho, which starts at zero. So phi f is at some negative value, and phi t is at some positive value. And we know that, based on a previous argument, our solution always starts between phi star and phi t. That's essentially the same as phi t. Phi star is very close to phi t. So initially, we're starting at somewhere in between phi star and phi t. There's approximately the same thing. And we have to stay there for a very long time, because we can't afford to lose very much energy if we're going to reach phi f, given that there's some damping. And then we should quickly traverse through this valley and reach phi f. If we spend too long here, we'll lose too much energy and we won't reach phi f. And then we're very close to phi f. So the solution basically looks like a bubble. Outside of the bubble, the field is equal to phi f, so it's in our false vacuum. And inside of the bubble, the field is essentially equal to phi t. And there's some very small region where there's a transition. So that's the wall of the bubble. So in this case, Euclidean action can be computed rather easily. There are just essentially two terms. So first we have a volume term. This is a volume term. And epsilon here is just the difference in the potential energy between the true and the false vacuum. Phi f minus phi u of phi t. So one region in this integral where we get a non-zero contribution is in the interior of the bubble, where our solution phi bar is essentially equal to phi t, and there's no gradient or kinetic terms. So we just get the volume of the region of a a ball in four dimensions with radius, some radius we don't know yet, times the difference in potential energy. So this is the only non-zero term in that region. And then we also have a contribution from the wall of the bubble, so this region where the kinetic and gradient terms are large. So it'll be the surface area of the bubble, which is just 2 pi squared r naught cubed times some surface tension. And after some algebra, you can manipulate, so these two terms will be non-zero. After some algebra, you can manipulate these two terms and write it in a slightly nicer term and write the surface tension as just the integral from phi f to phi t, d phi root 2 u. And we're looking for a solution with minimal action. So we should have that dSe dr naught is 0. And this is just plugging in our results from before, 2 pi squared r naught cubed epsilon plus 6 pi squared r naught squared sigma. So r naught should be 3 sigma over epsilon, and SE can be written as 27 pi squared sigma to the fourth, 2 epsilon cubed. Just plug this back in here. And so this result gives us some idea for how we expect things to scale, at least in this regime where the difference in potential energy is not too great. So this is one justification for why I said before that this prefactor is not super important. So this 27 pi squared over 2 is already order 100. And we've got here power law scaling in the tension and the energy difference. So it's not too hard with a modest hierarchy of scales to get another factor of, say, 100 from sigma to the fourth over epsilon cubed. You wouldn't need to make the energy scales of sigma and epsilon too different for that to occur. And so in that case, you can get a Euclidean action of 10 to the 4. Well, the prefactor is going to contain the units in this formula. We're computing something here that has a dimension of energy to the fourth, or length to the minus fourth. And if we take the ratio of the Hubble scale and the Planck scale, we get a factor of e to the 560. We take those ratios to the fourth. So that's negligible if sigma over epsilon is, say, 100. We don't really care what units. You can use any units you like. Okay. So in that case, the bubble nucleation rate would be exceptionally small, so small that it didn't matter what units you use. So the picture we have here in this thin wall case is that at some time, so stochastically, the bubbles will be nucleated in space-time. And after they nucleate, they will, we can use real-time dynamics to describe how they evolve. And so to determine the real-time evolution of these solutions, we can do a Wick rotation, tau goes to it. And so these bubbles will nucleate with some radius r naught. And r of t we just take our Euclidean solution in Wick rotate should just be root t squared plus r naught squared. So r of t for large t just grows linearly. So these bubbles approach, expand at the speed of light after a short time of order r naught. So they start off, the bubble walls start off with zero velocity, but they rapidly expand. Here, V is about one. So even if the bubble nucleation rate is low, once a bubble nucleates, it will expand rapidly, and a large region of space can be converted from the false vacuum into the true vacuum. Are there further questions or comments on bubble nucleation? Okay, of the vacuum. Okay. I'm going to spend the rest of today's class starting another topic, the theta vacua, or the vacuum of Yang-Mills theory. And so the question we're going to ask first is, what are the classical vacua? Of non-abelian gauge theory. So what we expect is that the one expectation you may have is that if the gauge field is zero everywhere, that corresponds to a vacuum solution. Because if A is zero, F should be zero. And so that should be one of the minimum energy solutions. So both all of our electric and magnetic fields, all of them will be zero. So that solution should have zero energy. But this is a gauge theory. So these may be some of the lowest energy field configurations. So should any field configuration that is gauge equivalent to this field configuration. So if we add I U D mu U inverse, where U is an element of the gauge group, this field configuration is pure gauge. So these field configurations should also have zero F mu nu, and so all the electric and magnetic fields are also zero. So we also expect any gauge field configuration of this form to be a vacuum solution, or one of the classical ground states. So what I'm going to argue this time and next time is that this set of field configurations is not continuously connected. We can't continuously deform every gauge field configuration of this form, every pure gauge field configuration into every other pure gauge field configuration. So these are not continuously connected, not deformable, into one another. And that tells us that if we have, so let's take two gauge field configurations that are not continuously deformable into one another, then if, at least if we restrict two gauge field configurations of this that are pure gauge, that means if we're going to continuously deform one pure gauge field configuration into another, in some cases we'll have to deform through configurations that are not pure gauge and therefore have finite energy. So there are barriers between, potential energy barriers between some of our vacuum solutions. So our vacuum solution, there are multiple different local minima, in other words. So the same thing is true if we have, if we looked at quantum mechanics, if we looked at our periodic potential, there were lots of minima, and in order to go from one minimum to another, we had to go through regions where the potential was not zero. And the same thing is true here. So this set of pure gauge field configurations, in order to move from some of these configurations to others in field space, we have to pass through regions where the energy is non-zero.
So the orbits are this, sorry.
Yeah, it's like kind of similar. I want to understand like the geometric, what is the geometry? What are we deforming?
What are we deforming? So we can imagine we have two configurations. I'll call them A1, which is I U1, U1, and we have a second field configuration, which is of this form. The claim is that I want to deform, at least for some choices of U1 and U2, I want to deform A1 into A2. I can't do that just by doing a gauge transformation.
So the action, so the gauge group, I'm sorry, quantum field theory too, like one of the things that was said a lot was that the gauge group acted, there was a group action of the gauge group on the space of fields.
Yes.
But if there's a group action, then that means that I can take, like, if there was a group action, then A1 mu, I can act by U1 inverse, right? A1 mu is constructed from A0, but acting with U1.
Mm-hmm.
So if I act by U1 inverse, I should get zero if it's a group representation. If it's a group action, sorry. And then I could act by U2, right?
In
A2 mu.
Yes. That's what you would, so what you're proposing is, act with the gauge transformation. Okay. Okay, a few minutes. there's essentially a topological obstruction to doing what you're proposing. I hope I can get there in the next 5 minutes to sketch where that comes from. But that's exactly where I'm going.
I have a guess. Is this kind of property of being unable to deform continuously connected to the essentially connected to the property of our gauge group itself? I mean, I feel no, the usual gauge group like UN, of course, they are not connected at all.
Yes, it does depend on the gauge group. So,
are they? And there are two things. One is the property of the gauge group itself, and the other thing is that property. Are they equivalent to each other?
Yes. So this statement about there being obstructions does depend on the gauge group and the dimension of space-time. So these obstructions are topological obstructions that have to do with the possible maps from space-time onto the gauge group, and will depend on both the dimension of space-time and the structure of the gauge group. I'll have more. I won't get there today, but I will have more to say about that on next time, Friday. Okay. I might not get the answer to your question today, but I will on Friday. So let me just sketch where we're going on Friday. So a claim that the gauge field configurations have some similarities to this periodic potential. And like the periodic potential we studied last week, which had a degenerate set of minima in Yagmils, at least for certain dimensions of space-time and certain gauge groups, there are an infinite set of degenerate minima. And if we want to calculate, find the quantum ground state, we need to account for the quantum mechanical energy level splittings between those classically degenerate ground state. And to do that, we need to find the finite action solutions to the Euclidean equation motion, or in other words, the instanton solutions that mediate tunneling between the various degenerate vacua. So what we need to look for are finite action field configurations that solve the Euclidean equations of motion. And what we're going to find is that we can separate these instanton solutions into classes based on topology. And there's a close relation between the obstruction that I claimed but didn't really show. I'll get back to that on Friday. And the reason why these instantons are separated into the different classes, which can't be continuously deformed into one another. So these instanton solutions will basically correspond to field configurations that mediate tunneling between the different classical sectors with zero energy. And that's where we'll go on Friday. And then we'll, in fact, these instanton solutions we'll find will have close connections to anomalies, which will be the next topic we'll study in this course, and we'll start that on Friday as well.
Yeah, I was wondering, this whole idea of having different vacua, That makes me think of super selection. So is there anything with charges? Can you define a charge, for example, for?
Yes, this is very closely related to super selection. The different so in the periodic potential in quantum mechanics, you have different energy. There's a continuum of low-lying energy eigenstates. In the Yang-Mills version, those will correspond to different super selection sectors, which won't talk to each other. So once you can show, at least in the infinite space-time volume limit, that the amplitude to go from one of these theta vacua to another is zero. So you can basically do physics independently in each sector.
Kind of charge that I can define to characterize the sectors?
Yes, there is. It's related to the instantons we'll talk about on Friday. Other questions? All right, see you in tutorial this afternoon.